Introduce tonight's Al-Anon speaker is our speaker seeker, Leonard.
Hi, I'm Leonard, your speaker seeker. And our speaker tonight was supposed to speak here in June, but he had to cancel at the last minute, and we got to hear his roommate, Unstable Jim. But so now, as Bullwinkle Moose would say, this time for sure. And so it's my pleasure to introduce to you Father Tom.
Oh my. Hi, folks. My name is Tom, and I'm in great need of a vast number of Al-Anon meetings. And I love the Bullwinkle the Moose reference. That is my generation. I learned a vast amount from Bullwinkle and Rocky the Squirrel when I was starting to negotiate being alive. Glad to share some Al-Anon with you. And I live in Oakland, California, but I'm in Los Angeles for the next 10 days. And right now I'm in Thai Town. I'm on Franklin and Western. And after this meeting, I'm walking about 5 minutes from here and taking one of those restaurants for dinner. And so I'm looking forward to the meeting, but I'm looking forward to the restaurant also. There's a porky, garlicky place just around the corner, and that has my attention. Glad to talk Al-Anon with you. And with announcements, up in the Bay Area, we're doing the Zoom plus live meetings. They seem to work if there's a couple of young people in the room who know how to turn things on. And so that's just good experience. Also, next very end of June, beginning in July, the Al-Anon International Convention every 5 years will be being held in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So just to say that out loud, I went to the International in Baltimore 4 years ago, and there were 4,000 or 5,000 people. In the other program, you get 60,000 or 70,000 people, and you're standing in line to pee for a long time. The Al-Anon convention is much more manageable. So you might think about coming to Albuquerque for the weekend. And people do come from all over. It's lovely. So happy to share experience, strength, and hope with you. I'm I think I've this time through, I've been regularly participating in Al-Anon world for 25 or 30 years. And I first put my toe in the Al-Anon water about 40 years ago. I was teaching kids. In fact, I was living here in Los Angeles, and I had some exposure to recovery already, but I was surrounded by high school kids. And as you know, high school kids are exactly like alcoholics. And the reverse is true. Alcoholics are exactly like high school kids. And with all the drama and trauma and the mood shifts and changes and all those things, and I'm a helper and I'm a rescuer and I'm intuitive and I respond. I react to all kinds of things. And within two or three years of teaching, I was exhausted and angry. And I just didn't know how to shake it. I remember I got a physical and I had some weirdness with thyroid and I did a few other things and I tried a few other adjustments and nothing was giving me any relief from the exhaustion and the rage. And I was with a group of people out in Riverside, I think. There's a Carmelite monastery retreat house out there. And it was a weekend full of men and women and AA and Al-Anon all mixed up. And Saturday night, they had a meeting and the AAs allowed the Al-Anons to speak. They don't always. And I heard a man talk. He was the Al-Anon. His wife was the alcoholic. And he said, in Al-Anon, I learn how to live with a crazy person and not go crazy. I heard that. I've had some contact with women in Al-Anon, but I never paid attention to them. I know that shocks you that a male would not pay attention to female. But this was a man, an older man, who seemed to be a real living human being. And I heard him make the Al-Anon a statement. And so I came back to Los Angeles. I was teaching at Loyola High School here in the middle of town. And I talked to my sponsor in the other program. And I said, I think I could use some Al-Anon. And so I started searching around for an Al-Anon meeting. You know, people are always looking for the good Al-Anon meeting. And I went to this one and I went to that one. And it wasn't very satisfying. I didn't, my opinion, Al-Anon's pretty subtle. And we talk about changing our focus from the other person to ourselves. And this is not quickly done and easily done for me. When I would hear them read those endless Al-Anon introduction things, you know, the only one I liked and identified with is some of us have become irritable and impossible without even knowing it. I recognized that one really well. But as far as the program, it was the image I have is it was like me trying to grab smoke. I just couldn't get it. So I went to some meetings. It gave a little bit of relief from the kids. That one of the slogans that I meditated on and adapted was act, don't react. That slogan, because I was reacting to kids. I was yelling at kids. I was the angry faculty member who was arguing with kids about stuff that doesn't matter. But I was living in that space. So I leave teaching. I think if I had an Al-Anon program, I could have stayed teaching longer. But I was getting to my mid to late 30s and they were still all 17 years old. So I had to run for my life. And I went from teaching high school kids to moving to West Oakland to do social work. So no crisis there. Notice I have an attraction for impossible situations. And I was working there for 3 years pretty intensely. And I needed desperate emergency Al-Anon because I was surrounded not just with people who were addicts and alcoholics, I was surrounded by enraged addicts and alcoholics and the hopelessness of so many people I was spending a lot of time with. So I went to Al-Anon kind of in a frenzy, looking around. And I thought it was time maybe to go back to therapy and work on some stuff, family stuff. And I started seeing a therapist in Berkeley. She was a psychiatrist who ran the methadone clinic in Berkeley. So she was not a romantic. And I met with her and we started talking about stuff. And it's with her, for the first time, I said out loud that my father was alcoholic. And as I said that, I felt shame. I felt embarrassment. I felt shame. I did not feel liberation. I did not feel joy. This was something we needed to pay attention to. I saw her for almost 2 years. And it was very helpful. And I went to an Al-Anon meeting for adult children. And that helped get me grounded. It wasn't just grabbing at smoke. I had more to deal with. And then, but still Al-Anon was pretty elusive to me. I got a cassette tape from a friend of mine in the program. Her name was Sally. She was also a high school teacher. And she stumbled across an Al-Anon speaker by the name of Blanche. And Blanche was at Permian Basin High School in West Texas. If you've watched the TV series Friday Night Lights, it's that world. And Blanche was an English teacher. And she explain things in ways I could understand. And again, maybe it was the teacher connection. But oh my goodness, I played that cassette tape over and over and over and over again. And one of the I need images, pictures to understand stuff. And she said, early in her talk, she said, in Al-Anon, we learn how to keep our sails out of other people's wind. And there's a lot of wind blowing. And I wrote that down. I wrote that down and thought about it. And I just noticed tornado gale winds everywhere and in my family and arguing and complaining. And it wasn't a family that argued and then everyone went to jail. It was a family where everyone argued and then just shut down. And no one would talk about anything for several more years. And then we'd gather together again. And we had secrets and there were things we avoided talking about. We never talked about alcoholism. On the Irish Catholic side of the family, alcoholics were called characters. And they would say things like, Sean is sure a character. And that meant don't let him drive, you know. But we just didn't talk about it. My father had his stuff. His father had difficulty with alcohol. I have a photograph of my father's grandfather sitting in Ireland, suffering from alcoholism, diabetes, and going blind with two of his daughters behind him. And I look a lot like him. So it's there. When I was talking to my sponsor, who's been sober a very, very long time, but his family, again, riddled with alcoholism. And he met a guy who said, are you so-and-so a family from so-and-so part of California? And my sponsor said, yeah, that's my family. And this old man said, I knew your grandfather. He was the oldest of six boys. He was the only one that did not die of alcoholism. He had one child, my sponsor's father, who died of alcoholism. So the family is just soaking in booze, you know. On the Swedish Lutheran side of the family, the way they talked about alcoholics was they were nervous people. And some of the relatives got so nervous, they got hospitalized to dry out. My mom was the big Swedish farm family. We're Swedish people off the boat. I was surrounded by people with funny accents who couldn't pronounce the letter J. You know, I mean, sure, that impacted me in many ways. But my mom referred to her mother as being a very nervous person, a farm wife with 10 kids. I get that. So part of coming into recovery in Al-Anon was learning how to talk about stuff using real words instead of avoiding or circumnavigating or minimizing, which are things I'm very, very good at. And I found if I was presented with an embarrassing or uncomfortable situation, one of the ways I'd react is by making people laugh. I was the funny kid. I could make people laugh or I could change the subject. I'm also very good at changing the subject. And then as I was doing this in my own imagination, I saw myself as imagination and self-understanding. I saw myself as someone who had great diplomatic skills. So I would go into impossible situations where everyone had toxicity and frenzy. And I thought I should be able to soothe all this misery. And that, do that for 20 or 30 years, and it's really very exhausting. So exhaustion, again, is part of my Al-Anon stuff. Blanche's cassette tape. In Al-Anon, we learn how to keep our sails out of other people's wind. She also said that when she grew up in Northern Florida, she married a Texan and they don't leave, you know, so she was in Texas forever. But she grew up in Northern Florida and she was told what you don't know can't hurt you. And she said, listen, what I did not know about alcoholism almost killed four people. And she was also told God helps those who help themselves. And she said, that's not true either. God helps those who ask. So learning about the disease and learning about the recovery has been really important for my last years. I'm in April, I turned 75. So it's this is getting serious. You know, I'm much closer to 90 than 50. And I want my, I'm still very active. I still do a lot of things. I'll be with the whole group of people for the next 10 days out in Sarah Retreat House in Malibu. I still stay active, but I want to, in my recovery, I get to do something about the quality of my being alive. And that's real important. A couple slogans I have found helpful. Live and let live. I get all mixed up in you. Years ago, as I was coming back into Al-Anon for the third time, a fellow I had been friends with years before, hadn't had anything to do with him in a while, but I heard through the grapevine that he was making some decisions about his life. And I disapproved of every one of his decisions. I was upset. I was angry. And I went to a meeting. And the live and let live was the topic. And part of live and let live is everybody gets to live their own lives. And everybody gets to make mistakes. This fellow, we're no longer friends. Life happened and we're very, very apart. He gets to do all kinds of silly, stupid things. So do I. I was going back east to do some stuff a few years ago and I knew where he lived. And I wrote him. I hadn't had contact with him in 10 or 15 years. And I wrote him and I just said, I know you're in such and such a town and I plan to be there. Hope you're doing well. So I gave him the opportunity to say, let's have coffee, let's have lunch, let's have dinner. Heard nothing. And about 2 weeks later, I get a very polite letter saying, it's nice to hear from you. I value our friendship when we were young, and I wish you well, which means don't call. I was okay with that. I didn't feel neglect. I mean, it's just, this is live and let live, you know? Very, very important for me. Another slogan that I have found crucial, and I've used this as an Al-Anon situations where things are explosive. It's the Al-Anon slogan where I simply say, I'll be right back. Something's going on and I'll be right back. And that gives me a chance to, you know, leave for a few moments and have a glass of orange juice and maybe an apple and take a couple of deep breaths and then go back to the situation. That has saved my life a couple of times. For years and years in Oakland, I've been working on precincts and elections and stuff like that. So I was in charge of the precinct, which is a great position for an Al-Anon person. I know the rules. I know the regulations. I'm handling it. And a woman came in and things had changed and she didn't know. And instead of a paper ballot, she had this and that. And she was just wild and snarly. And I was able to say to her, I'll be right back. And I went into the back and I got some orange juice and calmed down. And I went back and I dealt with her civilly and politely and she got to vote. I'll be right back. Another slogan I like very much is don't take the bait. Don't take the bait. Alcoholics, when I mention that to them, they look confused. Most Al-Anons get that right away because there's bait. You know, there's raw meat is thrown on the table and you can go for it. And this is true in my family, my immediate family, which has a lot of alcoholism on both sides. There are certain issues, there's certain topics that we could fight about for years and have. I was in St. Louis a few weekends ago. I have a friend there. We don't agree on very much, but there's a lot about him I like. So we were driving around and he was just throwing out these in my very mature adult decision-making process, he was just saying stuff that was dumb. And I didn't have to point it out. I didn't have to point it out. The bait was there and I just let it go into the stratosphere and we didn't have to argue about anything. Thank you, Al-Anon. The more dramatic variation of don't take the bait is don't pick up the grenade, because that happens too. Something is thrown out and it is deadly if you talk about it. I was in the Midwest and I was with a group and I gave some talks and I was, one of the things I was talking about was prohibition, which is the whole country goes crazy, 1920, 1933. I'm a broken down old historian. And I mentioned that prohibition was the first huge increase in federal power, police power, because you passed this law, now you have to enforce it. So the big growth of the government wasn't so much with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, but prohibition. Anyway, I thought that was an insightful thing to say. And the next day we're having lunch or dinner, and a fellow across the table from me said, "I disagree with you." This was a grenade coming about that. He said the first huge increase in federal power was not prohibition. It was the Emancipation Proclamation. And I had an insight that we were on the verge of talking about the Civil War. And I used another Al-Anon phrase that has saved my life on more than one occasion. I turned to the person next to me and I said, "Aren't these peas delicious?" It changed the subject, because the grenade, there's no way we're going to survive a grenade. And I get to do that. That was a choice I made, and I'm glad to have made the choice. Powerless and unmanageable. I have some regular conversations with Al-Anon people about how I perceive things and what I think is my business. And a lot of my Al-Anon program is minding my own business and keeping my big fat mouth shut, because a lot of times it's just not helpful. My friend Jim was speaking here in June. I guess he took my place, and we live in the same house. We're in the same community in Oakland. And Jim, if I have to run anything by someone, I can run it by him. There's a couple other people, but he's very, very convenient. And just talking about the Al-Anon craziness of trying to control everything, manage everything. In my men's group, which is not very big, Monday nights, that, you know, we don't, mothering, managing, manipulating. There's a fourth M. I added the fifth M, which is murder. We don't have to murder anybody one day at a time. Because sometimes it'd be for their own good, you know, and it just doesn't help. So we had a discussion about a lot of this, and one of the fellows who gets there, he has a complicated family, and in his house there's a lot of stairs, and he has this idea of shoving someone down the stairs because it doesn't really leave a mark, and you know, then the problems will be solved, right? And we had to, as we discussed our own experience with that kind of thinking, we decided, you could always shove someone down the stairs tomorrow. Today, we don't shove anybody down the stairs. And I find that to be life-giving. Live and let live. Don't pick up the grenade. Mind your own business. Act, don't react. When I'm reactive, I get caught up in other people's stuff. And I get caught up in their fear, or I get caught up in their anger. I used to think, now this is when I was a much younger man in my 20s and 30s, boy, I got involved in stuff that was none of my business. and this is one of the things that's deep in me, adrenaline. The sense of adrenaline is magic. And I would feel powerful and intimate and useful if the adrenaline was really flowing. And I have been in situations of taking people to emergency rooms pump my heart, you know, and somewhere in my mid-50s, the Al-Anon decision I made about my life was I want to live without trauma and without drama. And most of the time I do that. God's will comes up, you know, in the steps. If you're working steps, there's that 11th step asking of, you know, knowledge of what's God's will, whatever. Knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out. So I asked my sponsor, what's God's will? And he said, it is God's will for each of us to have a life. Go get one. Which means making decisions, you know, about being alive. And the way I've been trained, and, you know, being alive means three major areas: work, projects, creativity. And for years I was in the classroom, finding other kinds of work to be engaged in, beginning it, sticking with it when it gets boring or complicated, finishing it. Those are great big things for me still to this day. But I'm better at work and loving relationships and friendships, and quoting again my sponsor. So many of us, when we come into recovery, although we might be very enmeshed in people's lives, we feel very lonely. And there's a lot of isolation when you're trying to run everything, you know. So finding friends, finding companions, and finding allies. That's a lot of my recovery. And saying hello to people, making friends with people. I was with some younger people today, and I stayed about 15 minutes. They're much younger. And it was clear that they have other plans for the day than hanging out with me. It was fine. I came back to my room and did some stuff. I let them go. I let them live. Mm-hmm. Friends, and we're friends. Friends, companions, and allies. And then the third big thing in terms of having a human life, it's knowing how to play. It's knowing how to enjoy. It's knowing how to take delight in things. And I like music, and I like theater, and I like gardens, and I like trees, and I like reading. I mean, these are things I really enjoy doing. And I like, all during quarantine at my house, we've been watching those nice, polite British murder mysteries. So we have our favorite detectives, and I know this is an outside controversial issue, but I'm a great fan of Vera. Vera solves a lot of things, and she drinks a little, and I just find her endlessly attractive. But learning how to play, I didn't know how to do that, because even though I was a clown, all the joy had gone out of my life. And I think I had recreation, play, entertainment. I think I had that mixed up with wasting time. And it's not wasting time. It's really an important part of my being alive. So can I work? Can I love? Can I play? Back to the love thing for just a second. What is it? It's Paul in one of his letters. He has a lot of letters. Describes love, and his first, there's about 8 or 10 words in the description, but the first two are love is patient and love is kind. And as an older person, patience goes a long way. And being kind to people, instead of being sharp or snarly or sarcastic, all of which I'm capable of, the patience and the kindness works in lots of ways. So second step, first step for me, there is so much I have no control over. The second step being restored to sanity, work, love play. That I think that's what sanity means. God's will, get a life. You know, I know some of us, we get into Al-Anon and we change occupation. I went from high school teacher to social worker. Social worker wasn't quite enough of a description, but it was a very complicated job that I had not a lot of qualifications for. And I held on to it for 3 years and then let go of it to do other stuff. But I know a number of us come into Al-Anon and change careers. Nurses go from emergency room to pediatrics. That's a big topic. So God's will, getting alive. So here's the questions I ask when I have to make decisions, which is a lot. Grown-ups make a lot of decisions. I ask this. I ask what's practical, what's possible, and what's simple. That's where I want to go. That's where I want my life to go. I want to be full of practicality. I get impatient with endless conversations about the ether. I have no patience for it. I had a fellow who wanted to come and see me. I have a lot of education and I've read lots of things for many years. This fellow wanted to come and talk about esoteric ideas. And I can do that for an hour, but not once a month. And so the third month he came to talk about all these. I said, you know, I don't care about anything you're talking about. There are people who do. Let me give you a list of names, but I think this is a waste of both of our times. And that sounds a little harsh, doesn't it? But it was self-care because I was dreading these back and forth conversations about stuff that doesn't matter to me. What's practical? One of the things I like about the program is its practicality. Bill W., who puts the 12 steps together, had a very practical side of him. He could take abstract ideas and make them practical. I just read the biography of Thomas Edison about 3 weeks ago. Full of practicality. How do we make an electric light bulb? And he tries a zillion ways of doing it. And they try it with this event and that kind of material and this kind of material. And either nothing happens or it burns for 9 seconds and then burns out. And one of his co-workers was so discouraged. He says, we've run like 900 tests on this and we haven't learned a thing. And Edison said to him, we've learned 900 ways this doesn't work. Well, that's very pragmatic. What's pragmatic? What's practical? What's possible? I want to live with the world of possibility. When I was a high school boy, the play Man of La Mancha came out. And the great romantic song there was to dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeaten. It is a recipe for having a miserable life. But a lot of us thought that's how we should do it, you know. Oh, look, there's a dragon. So I look for that which is possible. And if something is impossible, you don't have to do it. Relief, practical, possible. And what's simple? I don't have a simple life. I have a lot of complication and I'm frequently attracted to complicated things, but over time, I want my day to be more simple and easier. There's nothing wrong with being easier. I like the Serenity Prayer. I have a question. How do I talk for 3 more hours or 10 more minutes, or am I done? That's a fair question to ask.
You talk Leonard? Until 8:25.
8:25. All right. Thank you. I like the Serenity Prayer. I mean, there's a lot of prayers, and I some I like and some I don't. And again, I prefer simplicity rather than King Jamesy language in prayer. But the Serenity Prayer, give me some serenity because I have to make decisions. And it's not a good idea to make decisions when I'm upset, when I'm enraged, when I'm full of fear. I mean, sometimes you have to make decisions because of an emergency, but it's most of the time I want to have some serenity, some peace, some quiet, some calm before I make decisions. And that might mean taking several days off. In my training and tradition, every year you're supposed to do a retreat for 8 to 10 days. Turning off the phone and turning off the internet and getting away from distraction and adrenaline and stimulation and calm down. And you might have to make decisions. Should I do this or should I do that? Should I say yes to this or should I leave that? I mean, those are decisions. So I want to have some serenity. And I heard a man in Texas in the retreat house in Lake Dallas. He said this, middle-aged white guy, and I'm sure he was worried. He said, I cannot change the past. I cannot change the truth. And I cannot change you. And that frees up the whole day. I mean, I can rehash the past. I can. We do this a lot in my family. Let's argue about whether it was on a Thursday or a Friday in 1937. I've been in the room when that argument was being held, but I can't change the past. And I don't have to go back and rehash things over and over and over again. I mean, I'm in a religious community that has literally argued about some things for 1,000 years. And that's not a sign of mental health or spiritual health. Absolutely not. So I can't change the past. I can't change the truth. Laws of physics. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. What goes up comes down. I mean, those are fundamental realities in the world of space and time and flesh and blood. Which I want to live in. I my spiritual understanding is that I'm really spiritual. I don't get away from space and time and skin and bone. I enter space and time and skin and bone. I mean, I really do believe in the physical world. I know that's controversial, but I really do. Can't change the past, can't change the truth. I include under the truth all the stuff about biology. Paying attention to my body. And one of my friends years ago told me, the body doesn't lie. Learning how to read my reactions about some stuff, if I become physically upset or changing in all kinds of ways, or if my stomach is upset when I meet some people, if someone gives me literally the creeps, I pay attention to that stuff. The body's real and digestion is real. And I'm so glad when it works. This is a 75-year-old talking. Can't change the past, can't change the truth. And I can't change you. And this is deep Al-Anon. Loving someone does not change them. It changes me. And hating someone does not change them, it changes me. So the notion of, I have such strong feelings for a person that'll protect them, doesn't protect people from anything. Oh my goodness. What can I change? Three things. I can change my thinking. I can change my behavior, and I can change my attitudes. And that is the focus of the 12 steps of the Al-Anon program. Changing my thinking. I need to get some new ideas. Boy, I had, when I finally got into recovery in Al-Anon, there were some old ideas I had to let go of because they were killing me. And I was busy reacting to family members and changing my thinking, changing my behavior, and changing my attitudes. Let me give an example of changing behavior that was fairly early in recovery. A lot of us in Al-Anon, we obsess about someone else, but we're not very good at self-care. Using a seatbelt. Using a seatbelt for self-protection, for self-care. This is before it became the law of the land. They had they did statistics and, you know, all those things people do. And there were 1,000 drunken driving accidents on the West Coast over a period of time. Not one of the drunk drivers was wearing a seatbelt. Not one. Because who has time, right? So I decided one of the things I could do for self-care is starting to use a seatbelt. There were a few other decisions I had to make. And I'm making some decisions now at 75. I'm watching very closely men in their 80s to see how they do this. And one of my friends in the program, he's 85. And he said, if you want to be active at 85, you better be active at 75, which means get out for a walk, do something, be physically. And that's not easy for me because I'd rather think about it than do it. I did a fourth step. I did a fourth step because I was told it's vital. It's a huge part of recovery. And I wrote about things I was resentful of and things I was afraid of and some craziness around money and some sexual stuff, you know, just all those basic things of being people. And even just so you know, there's I still get angry and I still get afraid. Sometimes I don't even know it. I'm so busy reacting. I'm not aware what I'm reacting to. So I need to, one of the things I live by is the words of the poets of my generation, Simon and Garfunkel, you know, to slow down. You move too fast. And that's been the story of my life. I do and I overdo, and then I do more. My folks got married in 1934. They were in San Jose. They ran off to Reno on a Friday. They got married and they were both back at work on Monday because they both had jobs. So one of the big messages in my family is good people work. Better people work harder. And I picked that up just watching how the hard work they did over and over and over again. When they were much younger, they did some play. But by the time I came along, I'm the youngest, play was long gone. Life was serious and life was hard. And as long as you were a steady, hard worker, you had value. And when I've gone through periods where I felt a huge amount of shame or self-loathing or things like that, my way out of it was to try harder. To do more, to work more. And if I was busy and working all the time, maybe my father would think I was a good guy. I mean, that's psychology 101, but there really is a lot of truth in that. And when I felt shame or guilt, let's work about something. Let's start doing stuff. I heard Blanche talk. This may have been on the safe. I don't know if it's on the same cassette I heard. I did meet her and I heard her live and we attended a couple of conferences together. One, they used to have a conference the week before Thanksgiving in Yosemite for years and years and years. And those days are gone. They're no longer doing that for 100 reasons. But Blanche came as the Al-Anon speaker for the Yosemite conference. And I got to pick her up at the airport, and she and her husband, and we took him to see Les Miserables in San Francisco. I felt so sophisticated. And her husband's a Texan named Bob. And we ended up in the middle of the Yosemite Valley. And Bob is looking up at these granite cliffs that go up 1,000 feet. And he said, "I have never seen hills like this before in my life." And we had to explain, we had to introduce to this fellow from Texas a new word. And the word was mountain. These are not hills, Bob. These are mountains. But I got a chance to hear Blanche live. And one of the things she talked about was some of us would rather feel guilty because we do not want to feel powerless. Powerless is too scary. But guilt means there's something I could have done if I had tried harder, done more, stayed later, showed up earlier. Answer, there must be something I could have done to prevent whatever happened. We'd rather feel guilty than powerless. I've been in the program long enough to have several friends who've suicided. Oh my. My friend Patricia suicided in 1994. She shot herself. She had just turned 50 and she put on 100 pounds and was really unhappy and was dating really violent men. And I'm still not over that one. I mean, that's a regular visitor for me. I should have known. I should have figured it out. And just not true. Powerless. Defects of character, I've got them. Let me just mention a few in case you haven't noticed some of them in the past 45 minutes or so. I have great trouble with authority figures. I basically hate them, but I want them to like me. And that creates some dishonest, smarmy ballet of working with these people. And I have to, when I'm around them, I just have to treat them like people and get out of the way because I'll be an idiot. I procrastinate. I'm too passive in some areas. I need to be more active in some areas. I get angry. I was at a meeting in Los Angeles and I mentioned that I get angry all the time. I tell people I'm surrounded by fools. You know, of course I get angry all the time. And this person in Los Angeles told me that if I were really spiritual, I'd never get angry. So here's the rule. Each year of recovery gives you one more second of response time. So the biggest difference between 5 years in recovery and 10 years in recovery is those additional 5 seconds that might save your life. Because I act, don't react. I can react very quickly and harshly. Especially if you press the right button. So I did not say that's the most stupid thing I've heard in a month. I did not say that, although it was true. That was the most stupid thing I've heard in a month. Instead, I had a few seconds of recovery, and then I said, that's very helpful, which is sarcasm, because that's not helpful at all. What a stupid thing to say to somebody. So, but I get angry. And when sometimes I don't even know I'm angry. I just think I'm right, you know? And there's no passion involved in that. It's just the mental processes. You know, I'm right and you're wrong, and let's walk over to the staircase and let's see what happens. angry. Fear, I don't notice fear, but I have a lot of fear and anxiety. And usually it gets translated into anger right away. But boy, I have fear. When I was doing my fourth step, fifth step, and then making amends. For 2 years, I lived in Spokane, Washington. I was going to school there at Gonzaga University, and they had us read philosophy, which is not a young man's subject, but they had us read a lot of philosophy. Some of it was interesting, and a lot of it was so boring and truly awful. And I was unhappy, and I didn't like Spokane, and I didn't want to be in Spokane, and all my problems were because of Spokane, and I was reacting to all the external circumstances. And I graduated from college. I went to teach. But whenever I talked about that period of my life, it was nothing but negativity, negative, negative, and nothing was my fault. So after 5 or 10 years of listening to me, and I didn't talk about it all the time, but when it came up, negativity, 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 them, my sponsor suggested that I might want to go back and revisit the place and see what it's like now. And this is not, what kind of a sponsor are you, is my question, you know? So I hated the idea, and I put it off for a year or two, but I finally, there was stuff to work on here. I bought a plane ticket. I flew back to Spokane. I was going to spend 5 days. A friend picked me up at the airport, took me down to the campus. It had been 15 years since I'd been there. New buildings were up, old buildings were down. It didn't look the same. I doubted my sanity. I doubted my memories. I walked around, I looked at stuff, and I was walking faster and faster and faster. And I didn't know what I was feeling, but it was panic. And I needed, this is wrong. I shouldn't be here. This is a terrible mistake. I'm going to ask my friend to drive me back to the airport, and I'll fly home today. I don't want to spend a single night here, much less 5 days. And I took a breath, and I had a little bit of recovery by this time. And I went to the chapel of the Jesuit faculty, and I'd been there before. And I sat down, and I did some breathing exercises, you know, which means breathing. You know, 10 deep breaths, and in through the nose and out through the mouth, and kind of settle me down. And the insight I had, and I'm in my 40s now, you know, was how terrified I was feeling. Fear, palpable, sweaty fear, wanting to run. And I stayed a little bit with it because I thought, let me look at this. And the insight came that that's what I was feeling every day for those 2 years I was there before. I was afraid every day. Who knows? There's a long list of things to be afraid of. But rather than feel the fear, I was just mad all the time. And in my adult, early old age life, I've got to watch the fear stuff. And it does come up. And there are things that can frighten me. And I need to know what those are. And I want to ask God for help. And I want to watch if I suddenly find myself inexplicably angry, there might be some fear there. So I keep an eye on that in my own defective character stuff, but that's regularly there for me. When I'm anxious, I want to go faster and do more as a way of numbing myself, I think. And so as a person in recovery, you know, slow down, you move too fast. I want to take a longer time to do fewer things. I have my calendar with me. I'm a very busy fellow, but I have blocks of time when I'm not very busy. Today, not very busy. Did simple things here. I got a massage this afternoon from an old massage guy I've known, a Ukrainian. You know, it was very, we connected. I got stretched. It was a very good thing. And after this, I'm having garlic and pork at the Thai place. So I'm doing some self-care. And I keep it real simple. Carrying the message, I do sponsor a couple of people. And I tried, you know, Al-Anon is, there's a lot of different people who need 100,000 Al-Anon meetings. I've tried sponsoring people married to alcoholics, but I don't get it. I have no sympathy for anyone who wants to marry an alcoholic. Why would you do that? So I'm not a good sponsor for that. And I don't have children. I taught them, but I don't have kids. So I don't, when I'm in my right mind, I do not give parenting advice. And I recommend that they talk to a mom or a dad or a grandmother or a grandfather because they know. But I can do the adult child thing. I can do that having grown up as the youngest child in a not a wildly dysfunctional home, but dysfunctional enough. You know, those, you don't talk, you don't trust, you don't feel. I talk, I've learned to talk about some stuff directly. I've learned to trust some people with my life, and I want to be trustworthy. And I'm much better on that whole world of feelings, which was like learning a whole new language to me. I'd rather think about them than have them. Having them is so inefficient. But I let myself, feelings come and they go. And I've learned how to talk about this. And when I'm listening to someone talking to me about their stuff, I can identify. I just identify and I can share my experience. And I learned this from Blanche. When her sponsored her by talking about her own experiences. And when I sponsor some people, I talk about my own experiences. I don't tell them what they should be doing or thinking or feeling, although I have, but I don't when I'm in my right mind. But I can share my stuff. That might be everything I know about everything, and this might be ending a couple of minutes early, but we're all grown-ups, and you can handle that. So listen, if there's anything I've said that's helpful, please use it. And if it's not helpful, don't worry about it, because it's, like I say, Al-Anon is a funny kind of program, and it takes me time. I do like the Courage to Change book. My first year or two in Al-Anon, I use the ODAT one day at a time. But it's mostly, it's a lot of wives giving, you know, talking to wives. And this has better voices. I can hear a little better. And I do like the book. Full disclosure, I don't use this every day, but I use this regularly. And I think that's everything. Thanks for the invitation. Glad to be alive. Happy Thursday night.